It is 8:08 in the Twin Cities. Great to be with you on a Saturday evening, 78 degrees. Joining me now, one of my absolute favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School. How are you?
I am doing very well. How are you tonight?
I am doing fine. As I've been saying, it's so great to have you on. You are just back from a trip to Israel, and I wasn't sure if – I know you do a lot of trips where you teach on behalf of the State Department. This was not one of those trips. You were actually at Hebrew University. So why don't you tell us what you were doing there?
Okay, so this is my second trip there at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, which is a very fine school. And what I was there for, it was a conference at the Truman Institute named – Institute for Peace, named after President Harry Truman. And the conference last year and the one this time was convening several elected officials from about a dozen countries across Africa, including many countries that have a large immigrant population in Minnesota, for example, such as Somalia, Nigeria, Liberia. And the conference was all about democracy and economic development in Africa. And what I was doing was giving a couple of talks and leading some discussions about what we know about the relationships between how countries economically grow and what that means in terms of the prospects for democracy. So that was the official part. The other unofficial part was on Tuesday afternoon, I had an opportunity to do a tour of the Old City. And
oh, wow.
And anybody want
to? I've always wanted to go.
Oh my gosh.
To Jerusalem and yes. to Israel and see yes. that. Because, I mean,
it's amazing. If anybody wants to go to my Facebook page, I posted four pictures there. And the four pictures that I posted, one of them was the Dome of the Rock, which is considered a very important place for all three major faiths, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish. Then a picture of the Wailing Wall. I was there, and I'll tell you a funny story about that in a second. And then I went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is where both the tomb of Jesus is, and like 15 feet away is the spot where Jesus was crucified. So I got a chance to sort of look at some of the major religious spots in Jerusalem, which are really quite sacred to all three major faiths.
Absolutely. And there, you have a, quote, funny story about the Wailing Wall?
The Wailing Wall, which one thing I didn't know about when I went over there is that when I was doing the tour and had a chance to go there, and someone said, are you going to send a letter to God? And I said, what do you mean by that? And
they said, they put the letter in the
you put the letters
wall.
In the cracks.
Yes,
right. And so, of course, I had to use the opportunity to put a letter in one of the cracks and send a letter to God.
Okay, we won't ask because we assume it's private. But that is pretty cool to have been there.
That's right.
So you were there though when some pretty big news broke here in the United States. Although it broke around 4 Central Time, 4:15, 4:30, mm-hmm. the firing of James Comey, which probably was the middle of the night.
Yeah, because,
over in Israel, right?
Yeah. For us, it's an 8-hour time difference, so 4 o'clock here would have been midnight. But given the fact I'm horrible with travel in terms of jet lag and time zones, I actually was probably up at midnight and when that broke and saw it. So we had an interesting discussion about the implications of that. I mean, clearly, just going over there, I think one of the concerns that before the Comey story broke was clearly the African countries, and there was a couple of people from the Israeli government there that I was talking to, sort of trying to discern any rhyme or reason or pattern to Trump's foreign policy and what it meant to the Middle East and Africa. And to be quite honest, it's kind of hard to figure that out.
Right. Well, so you're saying, like, even before this, because, and actually, you know, we started this show with Mary Curtin, who's a diplomat in residence at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. She's a retired diplomat.
Right.
She's in the academic realm right now. But she was talking about, you know, the colleagues that she still knows, that uncertainty is really – no matter whether you are a supporter of Mr. Trump's or somebody who is a critic, I think that seems to be a reality, that there seems to be a lot of uncertainty out there amongst our allies and perhaps those who are not our allies about what exactly the president is, what his foreign policy is.
Right.
And I will say that we do have some breaking foreign news policy. North Korea tests its first missile, apparently, within the past few hours since the election in the South. That just happened this evening.
Right.
So, but you're saying that what you were hearing was, what, uncertainty?
Uncertainty was the word. And I was going to say is that, you know, this is something, you know, so they're uncertain about it. And you might, and just sort of connect something back, you might recall it was about 4 weeks ago, I was actually at the State Department in Washington. We talked a little bit about this. And at that point, I was there the day when, late afternoon in the State Department, when the U.S. launched the missile attack against Syria. And I'm in the State Department late afternoon, and somebody kind of runs into one of the meetings I was in and says, turn on CNN, we're shooting missiles at Syria. And literally nobody at the State Department knew it in advance. And so they were finding out, you know, on television, which is not how the State Department should find out about something like that. But sort of carrying forward, Trump hasn't filled a lot of major positions in the State Department. So on the U.S. side, there's a lot of perplexity. And then internationally, there's also an incredible amount of perplexity. On top of which, while we were talking about Trump even before Comey, is that I think it is tomorrow or Monday that Trump is going to be in Jerusalem.
He's going to the Middle East.
He's going to the Middle East. He's going to be staying. I'll tell you another good story in a second. He's going to be staying at the King David Hotel, which is where Barack Obama stayed at also. But they were sort of talking about and anticipating Trump's visit to Jerusalem and Israel and what he might be talking about. And so all this was kind of speculation in terms of what it means for Israel, what it means for the Middle East, what it means for Africa. And then the Comey firing happened.
Was it this sort of inside baseball American politics not a big deal? Was it a big deal?
It's a big deal. It was a big deal over there also, because the questions they were asking me, you know, is because they're already concerned, as I think many Americans are, U.S. citizens or U.S. people in the U.S., about what happened in the elections last year. And several people are asking me, well, what is Trump's and his administration's connection with the Russian Federation? And so they were, even before the Comey firing, they were asking those questions. And then the Comey firing, they started asking me questions like, well, what does this mean in terms of the investigation? What does it mean for the Trump presidency? And so in many ways, they were asking very, very similar questions to what we're seeing in the United States, and which we'll probably talk a little bit about tonight also. So they are very intensely following the United States, especially in Israel, because, of course, the United States is Israel's biggest ally. We are one of their staunchest defenders. I think, what is it, we give more foreign aid, I think, to Israel than any other country in the world. So it's a very tight relationship. And so they're kind of trying to discern, I don't want to quite say reading tea leaves, but I'll use that as an expression. They're trying to read tea leaves and figure out what's going on in the United States, because that might help them have a better understanding of what it means to them. And so we spent a good chunk of the last day, in between sort of our other work, just sort of talking about Donald Trump and Comey.
Well, let me ask you this and refresh me. Where is Israel in terms of the relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin? Obviously, Mr. Putin has completely aligned himself with Bashar al-Assad, who is sort of almost a neighbor, basically, of Israel. I'm sure they can't be happy about that. But where do most, in terms of the Israeli government and the Israeli population, are they concerned about Vladimir Putin and his policies in terms of Crimea and some of the actions that he's taken in the past few years?
Yeah, there's no question they're very worried about it. I mean, they're concerned in terms of the fact that they see Russia's more expansive role in the world as playing out in Syria, in terms of, again, propping up the Assad regime there. They also speculate, and there may be truth to this, that they're propping up and helping Iran, and so they're supporting at least two of Israel's enemies, and therefore, of course, they're worried about what this might mean if, in fact, Trump and Putin are working very closely together, or they're somehow, there's some kind of rapprochement there. What does that mean for Israeli politics? And so that's why they're also anticipating and wondering what the meeting's going to be like with the Prime Minister Netanyahu and Donald Trump starting. I think it's Monday or Tuesday or something like that this coming week. So yes, they are very concerned and view Russia as an adversary of Israel.
All right. Well, listen, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd just like to get your take on the Comey firing and sort of some of the fallout with the discussions about Are there tapes? Are conversations being taped?
Sure.
Comey allegedly, according to the president, saying, "Don't worry, you're not under investigation." The appropriateness of that, all the questions surrounding this, what all that means from the legal perspective. So,
sure.
More with David Schultz after this. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 8:22 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz, just back from Israel, getting the reaction from the folks in Israel. Now, let me just get your take on this here.
Sure.
This has been obviously a pretty big deal. There are critics and a lot of independents who are expressing grave concerns about this firing. I will say, though, I do think it's important to remember that apparently I saw one poll that says more than 80% of Republicans say this is just fine what the president has done. What is your reading from the legal perspective, as well as the political perspective, of this firing?
Okay, let's start with the legal perspective first. And it does appear that Comey and the FBI were engaged in some type of investigation, we know that, regarding the Russian involvement in the U.S. elections, as well as it appears they were at least investigating Flynn, in terms of some of his connections.
And that's national security advisor who had to resign, and who just even the day before the firing, Sally Yates, the former acting attorney general, said that the Obama administration had actually warned Trump, and actually President Obama apparently personally warned Trump about him, saying, "We have intelligence that suggests he's had dealings with the Russians that are not appropriate."
Right, right. And so I mention that because that does seem to be the case, that there was an FBI investigation ongoing at this point. Now, legally, where I want to start is that if, in fact, Trump dismissed Comey for reasons to try to short circuit or to prevent that investigation from going forward, from a legal perspective, what this amounts to potentially is obstruction of justice. It is impeding a potential criminal investigation by the FBI, and that becomes pretty serious, because not to overwork the parallels back to Watergate nearly 40 years ago, but on one level, a lot of what Watergate was about were charges of obstruction of justice, cover-ups of the Watergate break-in. And so that's the one level where I start with here, is that understanding the motives and reasons. And this is partly where politically now Trump, his White House staff and communications department, has tripped over a variety of things, because we've noticed the last 48 to 72 hours in that area, is that we've seen conflicting reasons being offered for why Comey was dismissed. And that's actually critical from a legal perspective, because if, in fact, it was because of reasons, as I mentioned here, to impede a ongoing criminal investigation, then that does rise to a violation of federal law in terms of obstruction of justice. And that becomes serious, not just in terms of potential criminal issues, but also in terms of the fact that this now becomes perhaps more fodder for congressional investigation and obstruction of justice on a completely different plane becomes a possible factor that could be considered if Congress at some point wanted to move towards considerations of impeachment. So this is potentially, from a legal perspective, very, very serious. And again, that's why I mentioned why I think the Trump administration's conflicting reasons in terms of surrounding Comey's dismissal is so critical from just that legal perspective.
And one of the things that the memo from the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein talks all about the Comey handling of the Clinton email situation and the press conference and all of that. I guess even there are a few Republicans, even though most Republicans are clearly supporting the president on this, there are a number of Republicans, including, I think, Senator Burr, who's the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who are saying, "I can't understand the timing."
Mm-hmm.
Senator Ted Cruz, mm-hmm, of Texas said it would have been a lot cleaner, mm-hmm, to do this in January.
Exactly.
when you just came in. I guess that's the problem here,
right,
is if this is all about Hillary Clinton and the handling of her emails, which certainly a lot of Democrats feel handed the election to Hillary Clinton. I think that's a gross overstatement myself. But it's the timing that's doesn't add up.
Right. And again, rarely do we get circumstances in criminal situations where somebody explains to you very clearly what their intention is. Most of the time, you know, we hear like really bad movies that talk about circumstantial evidence. In many situations, evidence is circumstantial and contextual, and we oftentimes ascertain intent by timing. And the reason why I mentioned that, you're right, had on January 20th or 21st, he had asked for Comey's resignation, many people would have said, okay, that's his prerogative as president, whether it's because he wants his own person, he doesn't like what he did with Hillary Clinton's investigation, et cetera, et cetera. But for now it to be in this situation to where we are relatively deep into an investigation, again, the timing, especially, you know, after Acting Attorney General Yates had testified earlier in the week, raises again questions about intentionality, and then again now the disarray in the White House staff and communications department, all about again the reasoning, again sort of, you know, lead us towards thinking that it has something to do with the Russian investigation, and now there is an effort to try to cover up the real reasons for what they were doing.
That's what people are trying to figure out. And then the Rosenstein memo, the gist of that, the thrust of it is not Rosenstein saying he should have, you know, first of all, Comey can't indict anybody. He's just the FBI. But it's they're criticizing him for having the news conference in July,
mm-hmm,
and then going public in October.
Right.
I mean, it's all the things that the Democrats were upset about. And then, of course, you know, Trump is saying, hey, listen, all these Democrats wanted him fired, too, which
is
true.
Right.
But it's the waiting,
mm-hmm,
that is difficult to understand. And there are also indications that Comey went to the Attorney General's office asking for more resources for this investigation.
Right. And which again suggests that the investigation was moving into higher gear at this point in terms of going further. And again, leading some people to speculate that, in fact, they were starting to uncover some stuff. And again, not to overwork the analogy, but it puts us back to the situation of 1973 when Nixon fires Archibald Cox, when it be clear that Cox is now starting to request additional materials and getting what we eventually know was getting pretty close to the President of the United States in terms of investigation, and Nixon wanted to basically cut off that investigation. So again, not wanting to rot those parallels, but there are some parallels there.
Yeah, I guess there are some people who say, well, no, that's not completely analogous because that investigation was much further on. And I think that was at the point where Cox was trying to get his hands on the tapes.
Exactly.
The tapes that it was revealed that there were these tapes of all these conversations in the Oval Office. And Cox, the special prosecutor, tried to subpoena them. And that's when President Nixon want the Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire Cox, and Richardson wouldn't do it and resign, and his deputy wouldn't do it, William Ruckelshaus.
That's right.
And so then it's called the Saturday Night Massacre. But it's just and then what I don't understand, too, is, you know, the supporters of the president are dismissing, of course, any connection with Watergate. And it's a stretch still at this point. But then why allude to these tapes in the Oval Office?
I know.
Or the possibility of the tapes,
right,
in this tweet, saying, you know, Jim Comey better hope there aren't any tapes there. And then Sean Spicer yesterday at the briefing refusing to either say yes or no whether there are tapes in the Oval Office.
Right. This is all confusing, but not a surprise. Many presidents tape record for all kinds of reasons. And what this sets up now is another scenario, which is if, in fact, either Congress now requests as part of its investigation those White House tapes, or if there's a continued FBI investigation requests them, he will lose because U.S. versus Nixon, which is the major court case here, basically resolves the issue that says that presidents cannot claim executive privilege and refuse to comply with a subpoena in the face of a pending criminal investigation. You know, I'm a law professor, and so this would be one of those cases where I would say that if it's not four square, it's like three squares and 99 out of 100 perfect precedent, U.S. versus Nixon, for what could very well happen in this case. If tapes exist and Trump refuses them, he's going to lose.
All right. And how about this issue? And we do have to take a break, but we've got so much to talk about. But how about this issue of Trump asking Comey, am I under investigation? And Comey saying, no, you're not.
Two quick things here. First, timing is an issue. And second, I can tell you from having been on the end, you know, working in government, involved in some kind of investigations, you almost never tell people that they're under investigation. Or in this case here, you build firewalls up. Again, we don't exactly know what those conversations were and when they actually took place. But I would have been surprised if Comey would have been so candid to tell the president and say, you're not being investigated. That does not make sense in terms of what somebody like him would have done.
All right, because there are all sort of ethical and legal rules here.
Exactly.
We do have to take a quick break. We've got some weather, then we get a little break on the backside of that. More with David Schultz, and we also need to talk about the legislature as well. So much more ahead. Keep it here. You're listening to News Radio 830.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 8:37. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz on News Radio 830 WCCO. We were chatting in the break. You wanted to go into more sort of the potential legal fallout here. I mean, there are so many angles to this.
More the political fallout.
Political fallout.
Right.
And in the midst of this, I think even the president's supporters are trying to get him to ease off the Twitter.
Right.
But to renew his battle with Rosie O'Donnell almost led a surreal aspect to this, in the middle of this on Twitter. But what in terms of the political fallout? Because I do think it is important to remember and to look at some of these polls that show, you know, something. The Republican mainstream appears to be with him. There are a few Republican leaders who are raising some concerns, including John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Senator Byrd, the chair of the Intelligence Committee, Eric Paulson, Congressman Eric Paulson from Minnesota, calling for an independent investigation. But overall, it looks like he has the Republicans.
Right. He's solidly with Republicans. We know he doesn't have the Democrats who are solidly against him. The real battleground, of course, is what? It's with the swing voters. And the swing voters...
He has them.
And pardon me?
It does not look like he's got them.
He does not have them either. And this becomes critical because I think the real issue in terms of fallout now is what this means in terms of already now the 2018 congressional elections. And we know that the Republicans hold a 52-48 essentially balance in the Senate. There'll be roughly, 33 or 34 Senate seats up. The Democrats are looking at this as a possibility of Trump weighing down the Republicans in terms of the Senate elections and also hoping that they'll be able to make significant gains in the House of Representatives. And typically, midterm elections of a president's first term, the incumbent party doesn't do very well. And so I think the fallout now is to what extent does what's happening with Trump affect those critical, let's say, roughly 20 to 25 swing districts in the House of Representatives, those close Senate races, and does it have broader political carnage there? So I think that's one issue.
I mean, what did you think of Paulson, being Congressman Eric Paulson from the western Twin Cities suburbs, the Minnetonka area, coming out as one of the very few Republicans calling for a special investigator?
I think it's a fact that, first off, he voted in terms of the American Health Care Act, you know, which is basically the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and he's in a district that potentially could be swing, although he's been holding it, and the Republicans have held it for a while.
But I think Hillary Clinton won that district, I think, by more than 9 percentage points.
She did, and many of the seats in that district at the legislative level are held by Democrats. And so I think he's starting to look at this point in terms of the fact that this is Trump, and this is the kind of issue that could impact him in terms of his 2018 elections. And so I think he's responding, as many other Republicans are in swing districts, in terms of saying that maybe we have to worry about this. But I think the second political fallout at this point is the fact that, you know, even though Trump sort of did the high five a couple of weeks ago when the House voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, it hasn't cleared the Senate, and the prospects seem slim at this point. Trump still does not have a single major legislative victory now going to almost four months in office, which is just about unheard of. Almost every president has some legislative victories. And to what extent does the problems in the White House and with Trump create continuing turmoil that undermines both Trump's political agenda and this opportunity that Republicans have? Because for many
they've got the House, they got the Senate, and they got the presidency.
They can do whatever they want at this point. They could even get rid of the filibuster rule in the Senate and just clear the deck and pass any legislation they wanted. But they seem at this point so engulfed in all the controversies with Trump and his lack of leadership that it very well could be what? They accomplished almost nothing, that the stalemate that we saw under Obama, which was caused by split control between a Democratic president, Republican House and Senate, we could now have what? Polarization or stalemate intra-party, which is very unusual, almost unheard of. And so the Republicans are on the verge of not being able to move any of their legislative agenda when they have an incredibly golden opportunity to do so. And I don't see in the immediate prospects down the line that anything's going to change to where the Republicans are going to be able to actually do anything, because Trump's not putting forward anything and doesn't seem to be putting his efforts in terms of legislative initiatives. And to the extent that he's using executive orders are actually quite limited to what they can accomplish. Go ask Barack Obama, who couldn't get a lot done with executive orders.
Yeah. Interesting points, all of them. I do want to go back very quickly to Congressman Eric Paulson. I think within the week we will see an announcement of a pretty significant candidate announcing that he's going to run against mm-hmm. Congressman Paulson. And that candidate is Dean Phillips. He is probably best known as a businessman and a philanthropist. He is an heir to the Phillips liquor fortune. Mm-hmm. He's in his probably late 40s. Anyway, I think he is all in.
Right.
And I think he is going to be he has tremendous backing in Washington as well as, I think, here.
Right.
And I think he's going to be a formidable candidate. Now, that being said, Terry Bonoff, a very popular senator, state senator, ran against Congressman Paulson and did not do well at all. She was handily beaten, even though Hillary Clinton won that district easily. So obviously Congressman Paulson is still very popular in his district. But let's take a quick break.
Quickly before you take the break, one of the differences was also that Paulson had way more money than her. He's not going to have that money advantage against Phillips.
He will not have. I mean, I think that there's going to be a major. Not only does Dean Phillips have the potential to self-fund, but obviously I think that the Democrats are already getting behind him in terms of that. There will not be, you're absolutely right, a money advantage for Congressman Paulson in that race. Let's take a quick break, and then let's look at, they all got in a boat together and fished.
Yes.
We're talking about the leaders of the Minnesota legislature and Governor Mark Dayton, an impasse at hand with just a little over a week to go. Keep it here, News Radio 830. It is 8:47. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz, we've been talking about the situation with President Trump, and fascinating to see what's going to happen on this overseas trip, the first overseas trip, heading to where you just left. You crossed paths
We sort of did. Okay,
almost.
My quick story I was going to say is that he's going to be staying at the King David Hotel, which is where Obama stayed at before. And so one of the persons who actually gave me a tour used to work at the King David Hotel, so I got to sneak in and look at it. All right, so just to let folks know what the taxpayer cost is going to be, there's roughly 200 rooms in the King David Hotel. The starting price for those rooms is about $2,200 a night.
Wow.
So, and the Trump administration has that entire hotel booked.
As I'm sure that President Obama did as well.
Yes.
All right. And that's another story, the president's travel expenses. But let's focus now your thoughts about the Minnesota legislature. The leaders all and Governor Dayton all got into a boat today to go fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people caught fish.
Right. They did very well today, apparently.
But no movement. The governor had a bunch of vetoes on yesterday. The deadline is a week from Monday,
right,
to get this budget deal done, and it looks like there's absolutely no movement.
Right, because he vetoed, I think, the state budget consists of of 10 what's called omnibus funding bills that fund in 10 different areas of the government. And he was sent 5 of them, of which he vetoed. And there's another 5 pending out there. So where we really are as of Monday will be that we have 0-10 that have been signed by the governor, with essentially at that point 1 week to go. The governor and the legislature is very far apart on those omnibus bills under two dimensions. Dimension one, it's in terms of the actual spending, that in terms of how much is being spent and for what. Anywhere from debates by the governor wanting more money spent on education, money spent more on mass transportation, a whole bunch of different things like that. And then second is the concern that he has that many of these omnibus bills have weaved within them policy positions, which he also doesn't like. And so we will hit Monday with nothing having been signed by the governor, with 7 days to go, and no real indication outside of some sort of vague promises that the governor and the legislature will start negotiating. Not impossible in a week, but I think highly unlikely. And we might have even talked about how, right when the session started back in January, I suspect we talked about how there was a pretty good probability we should be thinking in terms of what, special session. I think that's the case. And now we should be thinking about whether or not they can get this all done by July 1st before the start of the next budget year to avoid another government shutdown in the way we had several years ago.
Well, and that's when you say the next budget year, that's July 1st.
Correct.
And I just, you know, there are all those budget proposals, but also you've got that real ID issue, which I think is going to be a significant one. I think people are going to be upset about that. It looks like you've got, in talking to the Republican legislative leaders, certainly House Speaker Kurt Dowd, I did ask him, I said, do you feel you have a mandate? And mm-hmm. he said, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the legislative mm-hmm. victories that obviously, once again, Republicans control the House, but also delivered the Senate as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. And yet I think that Governor Dayton feels very strongly that he too has a mandate, and that he is there, and his popularity is incredibly high. I mean, it's well over 60%.
I think it's the highest it's been since he's taken office.
Right.
If I remember correctly. And so
he also feels like he's got a mandate as well.
And a legacy
to protect.
Right.
And I think that is something that I think weighs very heavily on him. I mean, just having interviewed the governor, you know, numerous times, right, I just feel that this is somebody who feels very passionately about the causes that he believes in, you know, early childhood education, those kinds of things.
Right, because partly he ran for office when he said that he wanted to get Minnesota, in his opinion, back in the right direction in terms of spending on mass transportation, infrastructure, education, get the tax system aligned. And I don't think he's interested in walking away from his governorship after 8 years with those things not done. So he wants to move on this, and since he's not facing reelection, I don't think he has to worry in terms of reprisals from the voters, especially with his, you know, huge approval ratings. And so this is going to be interesting to watch this coming week. But you're right, coming back to it, you know, that things that we should be looking at is that you would have thought at the very, very least, at the top of the agenda, besides passing the budget, passing real ID would be something they would agree on, because this means come January 1st, Minnesotans aren't going to be able to travel internationally, get into many government buildings.
Or even according to the signs I saw at the airport, use your driver's license to get on a plane.
Exactly. Many people won't be able to get into military installations.
Well, and you told me that you know, when you go to the State Department, you make sure you've got your when you go to the State Department in Washington, D.C.,
right.
Not the State Department, you know, offices
around the world.
Around the world.
Oh, yeah.
But when you go, as you were very recently at the State Department, Washington, D.C., you made sure you had your passport with you. Would you have not been able to get in with just your Minnesota driver's license?
No, I would not have been able to get in.
To the and is this like a high security area of the United States State Department, or just into the United States State Department?
This, I eventually got into a higher security area, but just getting through the initial front door, I still could not have gotten in with my Minnesota ID.
Your driver's license.
My driver's license, of course. And that would be true with everybody. And even in the more secure areas, it would have been possible if you were a U.S. citizen to get in with a driver's license, Minnesota ID, driver's license. That's not going to happen. So think about that. That's the thing that's going to
happen. And that's already in effect in some areas. Most
right.
people don't have to go to the State Department
right.
for work the way you do occasionally. But
right.
I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
That's a very big deal. Not being able to fly, how many hundreds of thousands or millions of Minnesotans fly every year in terms of jobs, recreation, et cetera, et cetera. That shuts down. That shuts down on roughly January 1st. That's a problem. And then on top of which, again, think about other things that they said they wanted to do. Everybody for the second year in a row said, yep, we're going to pass a bonding bill. Second year in a row, they said, we're going to pass a transportation bill. I mean, we're really looking at nothing passing. And again, if I can go back even just to our budget, you know, and this is great. I can do this as a professor. We've got 10 parts of our budget, which means 10 points each. So I can do a quiz here. If my students went 0 for 10 in terms of a quiz, you know what the grade would be, of course.
I'm going to figure that one out. Yeah.
It's pretty easy to figure out here. And so you would have to say at this point, we're looking at right now an F. Even if only half of them pass, we're still looking at an F at this point. You know, at least a 60 or better is passing. And so we're looking at a pretty failed legislative session in terms of nothing passing.
I believe that we are going to be able to purchase liquor.
We will be able to liquor.
Beer on Sunday. I mean, like real beer on Sunday.
That's right.
July 1st.
Except for the first few Sundays for Certix, which won't probably be able to sell.
Right, poor Certix, yes.
Entirely. But you're right. And so it'll stand out that this is a session that we allowed Sunday liquor sales, but we couldn't get anything else done during the session. That is not a good assessment. In fact, it's a horrible indictment of the legislative process. And Minnesotans ought to be really, really upset, because if we were to go into another government shutdown, I mean, this all kicks in terms of what? It'll kick in terms of rest stops on the side of the roads. It'll kick into what, the state parks closing again. We've been through this before, and this is the kind of stuff that gets Minnesotans, rightly so, very, very annoyed.
Well, I remember certain, federally subsidized, or subsidized daycare centers closing down.
Yes.
Certainly, the state parks,
mm-hmm.
rest stops.
Mm-hmm.
Not to leave out the thousands of people who work for the state government,
exactly.
who are counting on their paychecks. They didn't get a paycheck. It was just
right. And also, we are. I think I'm not sure if we finished paying off yet the contractors who had contracts with Minnesota when that shutdown occurred, who didn't get paid, who faced delays, and we paid millions out to them. I actually did a blog way back then also during the shutdown and actually calculated, I can't even find it now, how many millions of dollars it cost us to wind down, shut down, and start up again.
Right.
It would have been cheaper just to pass lights on legislation and keep going. I mean, we spent lots and lots of money to shut down the government.
Well, it is going to be interesting because I think there, and also this time around we've got a surplus.
Yes.
Because in 2011, that was not the case.
Yep. Yeah, here they seem to be fighting even harder all about how to spend the money that we have, as opposed to trying to figure out where to come up with money to pay for our bills, which really shows the dysfunctionalism when usually people can be Santa Claus and give away stuff and everybody agrees to it. Here they can't even figure out how to be Santa Claus.
Right. And you know, there's so many issues here. And also there are a lot of in the Republican budget. I know that there are some cuts. The Republicans want tax cuts, but there are also some cuts to some social service programs that are also facing potential cuts under the Trump administration. That's a whole other issue, but it is pretty complicated. Well, listen, Professor David Schultz, thank you so much for coming on. I certainly appreciate it. And you'll be a guest tomorrow on our TV show, yes. WCCO Sunday Morning. Thank you so much. Insights are fabulous, as always.
Great. Looking forward to seeing everybody tomorrow.
Okay, great. The one and only David Schultz, folks. Goodness knows what could happen between now and 10:30 a.m. So we will have David Schultz there with his analysis. But obviously a lot going on in the world of politics. Actually, the fishing opener was enormously successful. I think it was like 40-plus fish. You would think that perhaps that success might engender some, well, togetherness, working together, fishing together, and no. Oh, well. Anyway, folks, thank you so much for listening. I want to thank Susan Blanche, the producer of this show, for doing such a great job. Also, Jonathan Lowe and Kevin Reed, our fabulous studio coordinators. Have a wonderful Saturday, everybody, and tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. tomorrow.